Ladies and gentlemen, I'm James Fraser and I'm Deputy Principal of UHI, and it's my very great pleasure to welcome you to this lecture tonight. It also gives me very great pleasure to introduce our speaker, the Reverend Professor Andrew McGowan. Andrew is a minister of the Church of Scotland, and as principal of a Highland Theological College at Dingwall, Andrew is one of the founding academic partners of the UHI Millennium Institute. And HTC makes an enormous contribution to the life of UHI, apart altogether from the many students that are trained and educated there. Andrew is UHI Professor of Theology, and he also holds an honorary professorship in Reformed Doctrine at the University of Aberdeen. He is an adjunct professor of theology at Reformed Theological Seminary and a visiting professor of theology at Westminster Theological Seminary, a professor to the power of four. He is also vice president of the World Reformed Fellowship. Andrew hails from Lanarkshire, a part of Scotland with a fine tradition of religious dissent, a revolutionary and radical spirit associated with the Covenanters. And Andrew, I'm tempted to add, is an exponent of this fine tradition. Andrew graduated from the University of Aberdeen in 1977 as a Bachelor of Divinity, and this was followed by a Master's in Theology in 1978 from Union Theological Seminary in New York. Andrew's first ministerial charge as a probationer minister and then as an ordained assistant was St. Cuthbert's in Edinburgh. From there he went to Malig, and as minister of Malig and the Small Isles, I'm sure this was a providential preparation for the geographic challenges of UHI. Andrew became director of the... Andrew then went on to Glasgow, to Postle and Henry Drummond Church of Scotland there. He became the first director of the Highland Theological Institute based at Murray College in Elgin. And that was in 1994. In the spring of 1999, the college moved premises to Dingwall and became Highland Theological College. Andrew has contributed to a number of books, and he's written a number of books, journals, theological dictionaries, and he's well placed to talk to us tonight on the subject of, is there a role for theology in a modern university? Andrew.
Thank you, James. I would like to begin tonight by thanking UHI for granting me this chair in theology. Having been part of UHI now for many years, my enthusiasm for the emerging university remains undiminished. My first charge as a minister of the Church of Scotland, as James indicated, was the parish of Malig and the Small Isles, consisting of six places of worship, five of which could only be reached by sea. I lived in Malig, and my area of responsibility included the Hebridean islands of Rum, Meg, Muck and Canna, the Noidart Peninsula, and the mainland villages of Malig and Morar. But what was interesting about that was that when I went there in 1980, any child who wanted to go on to university to do hires had to leave Malig at age 14 in order to go to the high school in Fort William, leaving on a Monday morning early and coming back on a Friday evening. It was not possible even to do your hires in Malig. But this past academic year, at the UHI Learning Centre in Malig, students were taking degree courses in rural health, rural development, environment and heritage, travel and tourism, and culture studies. There is even a student doing a PhD in sustainable mountain development. So from 28 years ago, when you couldn't even do your hires, now you can go right up to a PhD, and that's down to UHI. The idea of a federal collegiate university was an inspired vision, which has now become a reality on the ground, awaiting only the final decision of the Privy Council. It's a huge privilege to have been part of this development. Indeed, it was when I read in the newspaper, The Herald, in 1992, that there was to be this new university for the Highlands and Islands that wouldn't be a traditional build and a greenfield site, but was to be a federal university where each college would have a degree of independence, but together would form the university. It was in reading that I began to think about the possibility of a theological college and wrote a paper arguing that we should set up a theological college as part of this new university. It was the UHI vision that led to the HTC vision. And for all of these reasons, I count it a privilege to be standing here tonight to give this inaugural lecture as the UHI Professor of Theology. Let me now turn to the question I've chosen to address this evening. Is there a place for theology in a modern university? My reason for choosing this subject is twofold. At one extreme, there are those who say that theology does not belong in a modern university because they do not believe that the nature and content of the discipline is a proper academic subject. This is the view famously taken by a gentleman from Oxford who stood at this very podium a couple of months ago. Here is a quote from a paper that Professor Dawkins published 10 years ago now, entitled The Emptiness of Theology. What has theology ever said that is of the smallest use to anybody? When has theology ever said anything that is demonstrably true and is not obvious? I've listened to theologians, read them, debated against them. I have never heard any of them say anything of the smallest use, anything that was not either platitudinously obvious or downright false. If all the achievements of scientists were wiped out tomorrow, there would be no doctors but witch doctors, no transport faster than horses, no computers, no printed books, no agriculture beyond subsistence peasant farming. If all the achievements of theologians were wiped out tomorrow, would anyone notice the smallest difference? Even the bad achievements of scientists, the bombs and sonar-guided whaling vessels, work. The achievements of theologians don't do anything, don't affect anything, don't mean anything. What makes anyone think that theology is a subject at all? Well then. But you know, at the other extreme, there are those within the Christian church who say that theology does not belong within a university. And some of them are good friends of mine, because they say that theology should not be submitted to the accreditation, validation, and scrutiny of, quote, secular academic authorities. Rather, they say theology should only be taught by the church within a church-based seminary or college. Now, my intention this evening is to raise some issues which I trust will be a response to both of these extremes. Now, I know that militarily it's a risky strategy to engage in battle on two fronts at the same time, but nevertheless, that is my objective this evening. So then, is there a place for theology in a modern university? The first point I want to make, I've made 2 points, but I can't change it. I'm not good technically, but we'll come to the second one. Concentrate on the first one. This is a new question. Indeed, it's a question that would have been almost incomprehensible to scholars of earlier generations. For many centuries, it was simply assumed that theology would have a place, often the central place, in our universities. Most of our ancient universities were created by the church and not only assumed a Christian worldview as part of their intellectual foundation, but required their students and academic staff to formally affirm the Christian faith. The University of Oxford was established around the year 1180, with the University of Cambridge following in 1209. In both cases, it was required of students and academics alike that they be orthodox in their Christian profession. Indeed, until 1884, academic staff in both of these institutions were required to be members of the Church of England and to sign the 39 Articles. The ancient Scottish universities have a similar heritage. The University of St Andrews is the oldest in Scotland. It was originally created at the Augustinian Priory of St Andrews Cathedral and received a papal bull establishing it as a university in 1413. The University of Glasgow was founded in 1451 when the Pope granted a bull authorising Bishop William Turnbull of Glasgow to set up a university. The University of Aberdeen was founded in 1495 by William Elphinstone, Bishop of Aberdeen and Chancellor of Scotland. Now, someone might respond by saying, well, that's ancient history, and that whereas there may have been a place for theology in these ancient universities, my question is really asking, is there a place for theology in a modern university? And this respondent might well argue that new universities today take an entirely different view and have no place for theology. But this would not be entirely accurate. For example, the premier university in China is Beijing University. In order to strengthen its claim to be one of the world's leading universities, Beijing University sent a team of scholars to visit all of the leading universities in the world. The team reported back that there are departments of Christian theology in every major university in the world, including Oxford and Cambridge, Princeton, Harvard, Yale, and so on. The result of this was that Beijing University has now itself established a master's level course in Christian theology. And there is an interesting UHI footnote to this story, in that one of the international scholars who has taught on this program in Beijing University is UHI's Dr. Jamie Grant, based at the Highland Theological College. The question as to whether or not there is a place for theology in a modern university may be a new question, but the fact that theology does already have a place in the premier universities in the world, even in some very unlikely places, is itself in part an answer to the question. Secondly, and you've had time to think about that, this is a question which must be unpacked. I want to make clear what I mean by theology. In order to answer the question, is there a place for theology in a modern university, I want to be clear about what I mean. In particular, we must not confuse theology with religious studies. The difference is very important. In the early days of UHI, Professor Sir Graham Hills, on several occasions, tried to persuade me to expand our curriculum into a wider religious studies curriculum. He did so for a good reason, that we might expand our curriculum in order to increase student numbers. But in my view, he did not properly understand the relationship and the difference between the two disciplines. Theology from the two Greek words theos and logos means literally God talk or word about God. That is to say, theology is the discipline which seeks to talk about God on the basis of the belief that he exists and that he has chosen to make himself known by various acts of self-revelation. It is firmly based on the belief that there is a God and this God has spoken. Religious studies, on the other hand, is a sociological discipline. It seeks to compare and contrast different religions, different religious groups and their beliefs. It's interested in religious behavior, religious symbols and artifacts, religious buildings, and so on. We might put it more sharply by saying that theology talks about God, whereas religious studies talks about religious people, places, and things. No one challenges the right of religious studies to a place in the university, since it's regarded as an important sociological and comparative discipline within the general field of social sciences. It's the place of theology, properly understood, which is often challenged today, and hence the subject of this lecture. It must be said, however, that the demise of theology in many universities in the United Kingdom has come about partly because of the confusion of these two disciplines. Over the past 30 years, many departments of theologies, even faculties of theology in our universities, have been merged with departments of religious studies, and this has often led to a loss of their core identity and a proper vision for the discipline. This has come about partly because of pressure from university administrators to cut costs, rationalize departments, and maximize student numbers. None of them wrong in themselves, you understand, James. But it's also come about because many theologians themselves have ceased to be committed to the notion that there is a God who has spoken. Now, that may seem astonishing to many people that someone who is a Christian theologian might have ceased to believe that there is a God who has spoken, but it's nevertheless a fact which is widely recognized. You may remember the famous comedy program, Yes, Prime Minister, I think my favorite program of all time. But there was a particular episode of that program where Hacker, the Prime Minister, had been asked by the Crown Appointments Commission to nominate someone for their name to go before the Queen to be appointed as an Anglican bishop. The Prime Minister pointed out to Sir Humphrey, the senior civil servant, that one of the candidates did not appear to believe in God. The Cabinet Secretary replied, "Prime Minister, this is not a serious problem. Theology is a device to enable atheists to remain within the church." So then, when I ask if there is a place for theology in a modern university, I mean theology as traditionally understood and practiced by those who believe that there is a God who has spoken, and I do not mean religious studies. The third point I want to make is that those who question the right of theology to have a place in a modern university are normally working on the basis of Enlightenment presuppositions. The two great presuppositions which came out of the Enlightenment were human autonomy and the final authority of reason. Modernism, the worldview which emerged from the Enlightenment, was unsympathetic to anything which could not be demonstrated by sense perception and by logical reflection on the information obtained by sense perception. Human reason became the final criteria for all decision-making, ruling out any information or knowledge which could not be obtained by the human senses and verified by human logic. The key thinkers of that period proclaimed that humanity had come of age, and that autonomous human beings had no need of God or church or theology to help them open up the secrets of the universe, but by the use of reason they would soon be able to unlock all of these secrets and have full understanding of everything. And if the existence of God could not be demonstrated to the satisfaction of human reason, then clearly such a God did not exist. Now, the Enlightenment represents the most important transition in intellectual history that the world has ever known, and signaled the move towards secularization. Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher of the Enlightenment, argued that there was a place for religious belief, but it was in a noumenal realm, separate from the phenomenal realm, the latter being the realm of everyday life and experience. And that separation, that dualism, is deeply damaging to the possibility of an integrated and unified theory of knowledge. Effectively, it places religious knowledge and theological inquiry out with the bounds of public discourse and academic engagement into an entirely separate world. Unfortunately, from the middle of the 19th century onwards, theologians rather capitulated to this Enlightenment consensus and began to devise forms of theology which accepted the presupposition of Kantian dualism and sought to accommodate itself to this new philosophy. In particular, this was the case with the German school of theology, which centered on Schleiermacher, Ritschl, Harnack, and Hermann. Here was born what later came to be called liberal theology, where, having been told by the Enlightenment philosophers that real knowledge of a God was impossible and the supernatural was not to be expected, they created a Christianity which was stripped of its supernatural elements, a Christianity which had little place for the incarnation, the resurrection, the miracles of Jesus, and the supernatural work of a sovereign God. Instead, it became a self-help religion of good works, with a gradual change of focus and transition towards socio-political and economic concerns. Only through the work of Karl Barth and other theologians was this school of thought put to the sword, although it's taking an unconscionable time to die. There were, of course, Enlightenment thinkers who took a different view and retained their belief in the Christian faith. In Scotland, this was represented by the difference between the sceptic David Hume and the Christian Thomas Reid. Reid taught philosophy and other subjects at the University of Aberdeen and then became professor of moral philosophy at the University of Glasgow. He developed a philosophical method that became known as Scottish common sense realism. This was based on the conviction that there are certain self-evident truths which we do not need to prove, and among these was the existence, or the knowledge of the existence, of God. Much earlier, John Calvin had argued that there is within each human being a sensus divinitatis, a sense of God, and that that is evidenced by the fact that wherever people have been found, wherever tribes or languages have been discovered, there is always some form of religion, which Calvin argued was because there is within each human being the knowledge that there is a God and the natural inclination to worship, which has found its expression in many different ways. Scottish realism became the philosophical foundation for a whole school of theological thought centered on Princeton Theological Seminary in the United States of America. And today, Reid's philosophy is being repristinated and advocated by some of the leading philosophers of religion in the world, most notably Professor Alvin Plantinga of Notre Dame, who has now delivered in Scotland three sets of the Gifford Lectures, and Professor Nicholas Walterstorff of the University of Yale. Today, modernism is giving way to postmodernism. And postmodernism is challenging the meta-narrative which has governed academic life since the Enlightenment. Postmodern thinkers recognize and acknowledge that many benefits have come to humanity from the Enlightenment, not least the importance of rigorous intellectual inquiry, the need for scrutiny of all beliefs, and so on. But at the same time, they argue that the Enlightenment is widely recognized to have failed and to have been mistaken in its core presupposition, namely that autonomous human beings can, by the aid of reason alone, explain all the mysteries of the universe. Postmoderns also strongly argue that the idea of an objective scientific method where scholars come with no presuppositions is a myth. Everyone comes to their intellectual inquiry with certain presuppositions, or they begin to develop these as soon as they seek to obtain a hypothesis to explain the facts that they are discovering. But many do not accept this. For example, Richard Dawkins often portrays himself as an objective scientist who approaches matters unencumbered by presuppositions, whereas Christians, by contrast, are burdened down by presuppositions. This is, of course, nonsense. His atheism is as much a presupposition as my belief in God. Each of us is faced with a mass of facts and evidence. Each of us develops a theory or hypothesis to try and explain this evidence. His hypothesis is that everything that exists came about by pure chance. My hypothesis is that there is a creator. We both have presuppositions, and we both develop theories to explain the evidence. Nevertheless, there are many who would argue that theology has no place in a modern university because it does not follow a scientific method. Those who hold this view would argue that since theology is based on faith, it cannot be a science. And this is a view which ought to be challenged. The great early 20th century Dutch theologian Herman Bavinck, following in a long line of theologians, argued that the necessity of faith in the theologian should not be taken to deny the scientific character of theology. In fact, he argues strongly that theology is a science. He defines the task of theology in this way: nothing other than a scientific exposition of religious truth, a detailed exposition and interpretation of the Word of God. In order to clarify his argument that theology is a science, and to respond to those whose understanding of theological science excluded faith and personal commitment, Bavinck makes the point that not all scientific inquiry is carried on in the same manner. He rightly observes that the object of inquiry determines the nature and content of the investigation, and so knowledge of God must be acquired, quote, in a special way that corresponds to the nature of its object. Let me explain what I think he means by that. When I was a student, I had a job in the summer working in a laboratory where we tested the consistency and strength of concrete for the construction industry. What we did was, with each batch of concrete that was made, we took some sample blocks. We then submitted these blocks to increasing water pressure until the blocks split. We knew then the strength of that batch of concrete. That was the way we carried out a scientific test to establish the strength of the concrete. The medical scientist examining a human lung does not approach his subject in the same way as we did our concrete blocks, because that method would be inappropriate, not to say fatal, for the object of investigation. We could note similar differences in the way a botanical scientist might examine a flower, or an astronomical scientist might examine a distant planet. Theology is a science, but like all scientific enterprises, it must develop appropriate methods of investigation based on the nature of the object of study. God is not a concrete block, or a mathematical formula, or a distant planet. He is a living, personal being in Trinity who has chosen to make himself known. Our scientific, theological method must be appropriate to the nature and forms of God's self-revelation. No one has expounded this better than the very Reverend Professor T.F. Torrance in a number of his publications. Indeed, he was awarded the Templeton Prize for his work on the interface between theology and science. Professor Torrance's work constitutes one of the most significant assaults both on the Enlightenment worldview and on the liberal theology which arose out of it. He attacked the former for its dualism and the latter for its dependence upon a Newtonian scientific paradigm. A paradigm which argued that the universe was a closed causal continuum, entirely governed by cause and effect, and therefore there was no place for God or miracle or the supernatural. "Don't you realize," Torrance said to the liberal theologians, "that science has moved on and an Einsteinian cosmology speaks of an open and expanding universe, and therefore you don't have to develop a theology which is no place for God or miracle." Torrance argued that the starting point for epistemology is not ourselves and our questions, but knowledge of God. Knowledge which is both actual and objective. He says, and I quote, "We have to remind ourselves unceasingly that in our knowing of God, God always comes first, and that in a genuine theology, we do not think out of a center in ourselves, but out of a center in God and his activity of grace towards us." The only real dissimilarity between theology and the other sciences is on the matter of the object. For God is not simply an object to be studied, rather he is an acting subject, and so all our knowledge must be spoken of in the context of his sovereign revealed grace. For Torrance, this means that the only truly scientific theology is Reformed theology, which works from the perspective of the sovereignty of God. Knowledge of God comes by revelation, and the epitome of this revelation was the incarnation of Jesus Christ. And so Christological theology is true theology, and Christocentricity must be the characteristic of every search for true knowledge. The key role of revelation defines everything else, And so Torrance rejects an anthropological approach to God, as if you could say God by saying man in a loud voice. This is what Torrance concluded. In scientific theology, we begin with the actual knowledge of God, and we seek to test and clarify this knowledge by inquiring carefully into the relation between our knowing of God and God Himself in His being and nature. Then, in the light of this clarification, we seek to be more and more open and ready for God, so that we may respond faithfully and truly to all that He declares and discloses to us of Himself. It is through this disciplined obedience of the mind to God, as He gives Himself to be known, that we advance in knowledge of Him. Here then, we have two contrasting positions. The philosophy of the Enlightenment is based on the presupposition of human autonomy and the final authority of reason, where all thinking is self-centered. Whereas the Christian theologian works on the presupposition of the existence of God and insists that all thinking must be God-centered. Those who say that theology has no place in the university take the former position. I take the latter position. The fourth point I want to make is that this is a question to which others have already given an answer. I've already mentioned the negative answers given by Richard Dawkins and by my colleagues in some seminaries and church colleges. Others, of course, have given a positive answer to the question. Perhaps the most famous positive answer to the question was given by Cardinal John Henry Newman. He faced the issue head on in the lectures he gave, providing the rationale for a Christian university being established in Dublin, later published as The Idea of a University. It is one of the most famous books on this subject. It was later published, and his argument is powerful and has hardly been surpassed. The university which Newman established is known today as University College Dublin. Newman was quite clear that theology, based as it is in revelation from God, is real knowledge and so deserves its place within the university. He argued at length concerning the importance of this knowledge and for the useful effect of Christianity on all other disciplines. In fact, he addressed most specifically the question before us this evening. This is what he said. It is the fashion just now, as you well know, to erect so-called universities without making any provision in them at all for theological chairs. Institutions of this kind exist both here, Ireland, and in England. Such a procedure, though defended by writers of the generation just past, with much plausible argument and not a little wit, seemed to me an intellectual absurdity. And my reason for saying so runs with whatever abruptness into the form of a syllogism. A university, I should lay down, by its very name, professes to teach universal knowledge. Theology is surely a branch of knowledge. How then is it possible for it to profess all branches of knowledge and yet to exclude from the subjects of its teaching one which, to say the least, is as important and as large as any of them? I do not see that either premise of this argument is open to exception. Newman argued strongly that the university was good for theology and that theology was good for the university. Above all, however, he argued that it was impossible to exclude this area of theology from the university. And he gave many examples. And one of them was to speak about a human being. He said you can speak about a human being in various ways, in various relationships. You can speak of him in terms of the material elements of his body or his mental constitution, his household and family, the community in which he lives, the being who made him or whatever. And he said that in all of these ways, you can begin to talk about what a human being is. You can be a psychologist or a philosopher or an economist or a politician or whatever, or a theologian, and make some contribution to the interpretation as to the nature of what a human being is. But only when all of them are involved do you get the full picture of what a human being is. And so said Newman, to exclude any of the disciplines from the university is to weaken the university, to damage it, and to lead it to the place where it cannot fully explain the things it needs to explain. It is perhaps worth noting in passing, if I can be allowed a little hobby horse, is that one of the reasons why Newman argued so strongly for the teaching of theology was because of what he believed the purpose of a university to be. The purpose of a university, he said, was to pass on the body of knowledge to the next generation. That is to say, teaching was to be the primary function of a university. That is to say, teaching and not research and not all the other things in a university is primary. In our day, of course, teaching has been somewhat undervalued, largely because of the government's method of funding universities, not least through the research assessment exercise. The modern pressure for research has left many fine university teachers marginalized. The most important question asked at interview in the ancient universities and in most of the modern ones now is not, can you teach? But what publications will you bring to the research assessment exercise? Newman argued that the research was the responsibility of the royal societies and other independent scholars and not the universities. I think he went too far one way, and the RAE culture has driven us too far the other way. There must surely be a happy medium somewhere in between. The fifth point I want to make is that this is a question which raises the relationship between the church and the academy. This question is raised from two perspectives. First, it's raised by those who believe in the separation of church and academy, arguing that only the church has the right to teach theology and that seminaries should not submit their teaching to the scrutiny of what they would regard as secular academic institutions. Second, it's raised by those who believe that a theologian who has a faith commitment or believes in a confession of faith cannot be objective in his studies and therefore should be excluded from the academy. Let's consider the first type of objection, namely that there should be a separation of church and academy. This objection was raised in one forum as early as the second century, but it's sometimes been misunderstood. Athens was a great city of the ancient world, a city of high culture, of great architectural beauty, the home of fine sculptors, writers, and orators. But in particular, it was a city famous for its philosophers and thinkers. Athens had been the city of philosophers for centuries. Several hundred years before Christ was born, Plato had formed his academy in Athens, the forerunner of the modern university. Aristotle was a student at the academy, but then went on to found his Lyceum as an alternative or rival college. And one of the great concerns of early Christian theologians was that people were trying to take the philosophy of Plato or Aristotle and build their Christian theology on top. And it was the theologian Tertullian, writing at the end of the 2nd century, who warned against this danger and famously said, "What has Jerusalem to do with Athens? What concord is there between the academy and the church?" The point he was making was that Christian theology cannot be built on the foundation of pagan philosophy. Throughout the centuries, Christians have tried to build their theology on the foundation of various philosophies. In the medieval period, Aristotle provided the foundation. At the Enlightenment period, as we've seen, Immanuel Kant and others provided the foundation for the emerging liberal theology. In the 20th century, attempts were made to build a theology on the basis of existentialist philosophy. But all of these attempts failed, because a Christian theology can only be built on the foundation of a Christian philosophy or worldview. In other words, we must get our philosophy as well as our theology from God's self-revelation. Perhaps the greatest theologian it was ever my privilege to meet was Professor Cornelius Van Til. He spent his entire life getting across this message about the need for a Christian philosophy upon which to build a Christian theology, and believed in this presuppositional approach to things. He also showed very clearly the dangers of building on the foundation of secular philosophy. He argued that those who deny the miracles, the incarnation, the resurrection, and so on, do so because they bring to theology the presuppositions from their secular philosophy, and that determines that they cannot believe what the Bible teaches. And so they, as it were, undermine the revelation of God because they have come to the revelation of God with a pagan secular philosophy. And Van Til fought that all his life, such that in honor of his 75th birthday, they honored him with a festschrift and called it Jerusalem and Athens. But it's important to notice that neither Tertullian nor Van Til were arguing that there is no place for theology in the academy. Rather, they were saying that Christian theology cannot be constructed on the basis of a philosophy solely drawn from the academy. Those who argue today that theology must be confined to church seminaries present a rather different argument. They say that when a university validates a degree program offered by a church college, the validation panel will inevitably seek to change or modify the content of the course based on secular presuppositions. Indeed, when we began the Highland Theological College, one of the early members of our board argued emphatically that we must not submit to validation. He is now principal of a college which itself has sought validation, so his views at least have changed. But of course, it was based on a misunderstanding. As the Quality Assurance Agency has made clear, validation panels are required to test academic standards and quality, to ensure that teaching is at an appropriate academic level, that there is coherence and balance in the content of the course, and that there is appropriate progression between levels. And all of this is precisely what we would want to see in a degree course, and the pressure to maintain high academic standards is a good thing and not a bad thing. The second type of objection comes from the other extreme, from those who say that it's not possible to have a confessional position and at the same time to have academic freedom. It's normally expressed in this way: how can you combine academic rigor with confessional subscription? The argument is that complete academic freedom and detachment are necessary in order to be able to engage in serious study. Any kind of prior faith or commitment makes it virtually impossible to be truly academic. I've already said that I think nowadays people are more aware of the fact that everyone comes to their study with certain presuppositions. If anything, the Christian theologian is more honest in that he explains what they are up front. The origins of the argument concerning the incompatibility of academic freedom and confessional subscription, or indeed any deep faith commitment, can of course be traced back to the Enlightenment. The logical conclusion of having accepted Kantian dualism is that religion becomes a private matter up in this noumenal realm, separated from the real world of sensory experience and hence unable to make definitive truth claims. And ultimately, those who believe that faith commitment is incompatible with academic freedom are shown to be relativists. They believe that any opinion is as important as any other opinion, and that the only ultimate sin is to believe that anything is true. Because if you affirm that something is true, you are affirming that something else may be false. And within the academic environment, that of course is inappropriate if you hold to a relativist position. In other words, a paradigm shift has taken place in Western society since the Enlightenment. A paradigm shift which is rarely challenged. No one exposed this better than Alan Bloom in his brilliant book, if you've never read it, The Closing of the American Mind. This is a rather long quotation, but I hope you'll bear with me. There is one thing a professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering the university believes, or says he believes, that truth is relative. If this belief is put to the test, one can count on the student's reaction. They will be uncomprehending. That anyone should regard the proposition as not self-evident astonishes them, as though he were calling into question 2 plus 2 equals 4. These are things you don't think about. The students' backgrounds are as various as America can provide. Some are religious, some atheists, some are to the left, some to the right, some intend to be scientists, some humanists or professionals or businessmen, some are poor, some rich. They are unified only in their relativism and in their allegiance to equality. And the two are related in a moral intention. The relativity of truth is not a theoretical insight, but a moral postulate. The condition of a free society, or so they see it. They have all been equipped with this framework early on, and it is the modern replacement for the inalienable natural rights that used to be the traditional American grounds for a free society. That it is a moral issue for students is revealed by the character of their response when challenged. A combination of disbelief and indignation. Are you an absolutist? The only alternative they know, uttered in the same tone as, are you a monarchist or do you really believe in witches? This latter leads into indignation, for someone who believes in witches might well be a witch hunter or a Salem judge. The danger they have been taught to fear from absolutism is not error, but intolerance, Relativism is necessary to openness, and this openness is the virtue, the only virtue, which all primary education for more than 50 years has dedicated itself to inculcating. Openness. And the relativism that makes it the only plausible stance in the face of various claims to truth and various ways of life and kinds of human beings is the great insight of our times. The true believer is the real danger. The study of history and culture teaches that all the world was mad in the past. Men always thought that they were right, and that led to wars, persecutions, slavery, xenophobia, racism, and chauvinism. The point is not to correct the mistakes and really be right. Rather, it's not to think you're right at all. Bloom's analysis is surely correct and widely applicable. It may well be that the right to think from a Christian perspective and to have that thinking recognized as legitimate may be the greatest challenge facing Christian theologians in the coming days. In my own denomination, there has always been the closest of relationships between the church and the academy. The Church of Scotland has no theological colleges of its own, but rather, if we may say, subcontracts the education and training of its ministers to the universities. This concordat, as it's been called, between the Kirk and the universities was until 2006 restricted to the universities of Edinburgh, Glasgow, Aberdeen and St Andrews. Then in 2006, UHI was added to the list of approved institutions. The relationship between church and academy has been, sometimes but not always, and should be always, a positive one for various reasons. First, it helps to prevent sectarian or catechetical theology, where students only read books that they know in advance they will agree with, and only read within their own denominational tradition, and do not read books from other traditions or engage with other theologians. This is much more of a problem in denominational seminaries. Second, it ensures that the education and training of ministers is conducted at the highest academic level with appropriate academic standards and quality assurance. This, you see, was one of the great demands of the reformers at the Reformation, that their ministers should be educated at university level. The Renaissance, you see, had brought about a renewed interest in classical study and investigation. The rallying cry was ad fontes, back to the sources. This meant initially the rediscovery of Greek and Roman writings of an earlier day. But as the Reformation began, it involved going back to the source documents of the Old and New Testament, the Hebrew and Greek manuscripts, going back to the early Greek fathers, the early Latin fathers. And all of this study led to a renewed interest in biblical interpretation. For the reformers put the scriptures at the heart of the life of the church. And this great concern to have a ministry who understood and could expound the scriptures was a high calling. And this was what led to the close relationship between the church and the universities in the post-Reformation period, including the way things developed in Scotland. It seems to me that theology belongs in the academy, and that dangers only arise when the academy is taken over by those who fundamentally question the possibility of any relationship between faith and academic work, or who affirm relativism rather than the teaching of God's self-revelation. That brings me to my sixth, and you'll be pleased to know, last point. I want to make a point simply that this is a question in which I have a personal interest. Clearly, if you're giving an inaugural lecture entitled, Is There a Place for Theology in a Modern University?, and you come to the conclusion that there is not, then you must also resign the chair to which you have just been inaugurated. However, this is a question in which I have a personal interest. The existence of God and the importance of his self-revelation are not for me matters of passing academic interest. The University of Aberdeen is my alma mater. Both my Bachelor of Divinity and my PhD were taken in the University of Aberdeen. The motto of that university is taken from the Bible, from Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Only after I left Aberdeen and began to study further in philosophy and theology and apologetics did I fully realize that this is not simply a nice motto, but is in fact a fundamental philosophical and theological principle. Christianity, as well as offering a radical critique of the human condition and calling people to faith in Jesus Christ, also offers a means of integrating all knowledge. Never make the mistake of thinking that Christianity is simply some pious movement concerned with how you spend your Sundays. It affects everything, not least how we think. I am convinced that without a God-centered worldview, we cannot make sense of anything, and that no true knowledge can be had of anything if God is left out of the picture, if he's not given his proper place at the center. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Only when we know that there is a God and that he is creator and understand how everything relates to him can we truly begin to build an integrated knowledge base. When early scientists began to study astronomy, they couldn't get it right at all because they thought that everything centered around this planet. Only when they realized that the Earth revolves around the Sun instead of the other way about did they begin to put the pieces together in such a way as to understand the solar system. In a similar way, many people try to understand the world without reference to God. In my view, this makes it impossible for real sustainable knowledge to take place. Facts discovered by scientists may be true, but unless they're understood in the proper context, where God is viewed as creator and center, then they make no ultimate sense and therefore do not constitute real and ultimate truth. Professor Van Til illustrated this by speaking about a string of beads. Imagine, he said, that you have beads all over the floor and you have a piece of string, but you can't find either end of the string. Because of this, you can't get the beads all threaded together. So it is with human knowledge. If we leave God out and try to understand the world without him, then we might have many beads or facts, but no string to hold them together. I might, in an uncharacteristically provocative way, put it like this. The most brilliant professor in Oxford, if he happens to be an atheist, has less real knowledge than the person who became a Christian yesterday. The professor in Oxford has lots of facts and information, but because he has left God out of the picture, he cannot understand the facts properly, he cannot see how they all fit together, and he cannot develop an integrated system of knowledge. All attempts to do so without God ultimately fail. In conclusion, then, I would argue that there is a place for theology in a modern university. It's also my conviction that there needs to be more dialogue within and beyond the university at an academic and intellectual level between theologians and those academics from other disciplines. Very often when major debates are taking place, sponsored by the universities, the royal societies, by government, by private think tanks or whatever, theologians are left outside the discussion. In particular, I think that theologians must contribute more to the national debate about identity and the cultural and moral ethos of the nation, and I think we have a right to do so. For a considerable time, when the great and the good debate these matters, Christians have largely been excluded from the discussion. I think it's time to reclaim our right to speak, because Christian theologians represent a significant minority of Christians within the country as a whole, and a very large minority within the Highlands and Islands. So I would like to see dialogue between the theologians of UHI and those in the other disciplines, between the theologians of UHI and the business and academic and other communities within the Highlands and Island, so as to identify issues where we can think together and work together in order to reach helpful conclusions. I have been convinced for a very long time, of course, that Christianity is true. It has not been so long that I was convinced that theology belongs in the university. I too, for a very long time, thought that it would be better if it was out with the university. But I believe now that I was wrong, and that Christianity and Christian theology does have a place in a modern university. Thank you.